Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th.
We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
That's the way it is.
That's just the way it is.
God damn. That's the way it is. Things will never be the same. Who did that song?
I don't even know.
Yeah, me neither.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is Katie Reif. She's a senior writer of the AV Club, co-hosts the AV Club's film podcast, Film Club, and is a programmer with the Music Box Theater in Chicago.
Yay!
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show! I'm so excited. I've wanted to do this show for such a long time. I'm so glad it's finally happening. This is great.
You know, we have like this huge list of people we want to talk to. We just got to get everyone on, but there's only so many episodes. So
yeah,
I'm so glad that you're here because spoiler alert, I can't wait to talk about this movie.
But it's funny though, because I also feel like we thought when we first started this, we'd have no one to talk to. Remember that? Mm. When you're like, oh, there's no guests. No one would want to talk to us. And I was like, oh, that's exciting. Everyone wants
to be
our
friend. Topic, you know, like, you know, I'm just going to praise you guys for a second and say that, like, you know, coming on and be like, let's talk about this film is one thing. But when you put a fun angle on it, like talk about your childhood trauma, that just makes it all the more appealing.
We think so. And it seems to, you know, it's sometimes people are like, you're just going to traumatize me again on this podcast. And it's like, yeah, okay, well, we could do that. Sure.
Yes. If you want to.
Yeah, go for it. We'll laugh through it. We'll cry together. We've done both.
Oh, we so, have like, done both.
I'll cry. I'll cry with you. I cry all the time.
So before we do get too far ahead, let's take it back to the beginning. How did you get introduced to horror?
Well, what's interesting is my parents were against me watching anything R-rated. They were, we weren't super churchy until I got a little older, but they were church-going types and, you know, no R-rated movies in the house, no cable television, nothing like that. And so I had to get into horror through kind of sideways means. I was like, listen, I don't know what they were trying to do, but they could not stop me from being a morbid little weirdo. Like, that just wasn't going to happen.
That's a trend, though. I feel like if you're going to be a morbid little weirdo, nothing is going to stop you from being a morbid little weirdo. Like, you're going to find out how to do it. Sorry, parents. Like, if your kid's a weirdo, they're just going to be a fucking weirdo.
So, yeah, like I had a few things like the Universal Monster movies. I definitely saw those when I was a kid. I have like really fond memories of going trick-or-treating and then watching the Universal Monster movies after. And that was like a big formative experience for me. And also, okay, here's a little story from my childhood. My uncle was a cable guy. And so we had cable for one glorious summer. I think it was 1993 when my uncle came to the house in June and was like, shh, don't tell anybody, and flipped the cable switch. So we had HBO. We had all the pay channels for like a summer. And then at the end of the summer, in like August, he comes back and says, guys, I'm really sorry, but like my boss is on to me and had to turn off our cable. So what happened was they my parents taped everything that was on HBO like that summer. And so
that's fucking smart.
Yeah. And so we would just watch those movies like forever. And one of the movies that played randomly on HBO late at night in the summer of 1993, maybe 94, I don't remember exactly, was The Shining. And I was a latchkey kid who was home by myself in the afternoons. And so I would watch The Shining every single afternoon when I got home from school.
Wow.
So can you recite the entire thing?
I don't know about that, but
that's wild.
Yeah. And like, and I would like leave the tape at the part I left off at and then, you know, start at that part the next day and just watch it every single day.
That's amazing. So are you a huge fan of that movie?
Yeah, I love that movie. Yeah.
That's fucking
cool.
But
it could have been anything, truly. Like, it could have been any R-rated horror movie. It probably did shape my taste in some ways, where I tend to go for the more artsy kind of, you know, stuff with the striking cinematography. But, like, it could have been a Friday the 13th movie, and I still would have watched it every single day after school.
Do you think that was your first introduction to R-rated horror, or...?
Yeah, for sure.
What did you what did you think of it at that age? Like, what did you think of that? What was your reaction to that movie? Because I think I saw that when I was like 11 or 12, and I was like, I liked it, but I was just very. I don't think I did not get it the way I do now as an adult.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, I didn't understand the stuff with the bear or the lady.
Oh my god,
the
fucking bear. And my dad was like, don't worry about it. And I'm like, well, now I'm going to worry about it because that's fucking creepy. So yes, that bear has haunted my life forever, as many others, I bet.
I remember, like, you know, not getting that or the old lady in the bathtub or, you know, any of that kind of imagery didn't really make a lot of sense to me. But the scene where Jack, where Wendy's on the stairs with the baseball bat and he's like, come here, Wendy, give me the bat.
Oh,
like
that
freaked me out when I was a little kid.
Understandably so.
Yeah, it's still pretty freaky now. So, yeah.
So I have to ask, what of the Universal Monster movies, did you have a favorite of them?
I think my favorite's the original Dracula, but I like the original Mummy, too. The Mummy's a good one.
It is a good one.
Yeah. One I didn't watch until I was an adult that I just watched recently was Dracula's Daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that one's good.
Oh, yeah.
It is a good one.
It's a really good one.
I was on a quest to watch every lesbian vampire movie I could find for a little while.
As you should. As you did. I think everyone needs to go on that journey.
That sounds like a journey that I'd like to be on for the rest of my life, actually. So what draws you to horror now as an adult?
Okay, I was actually just talking to someone about this morning, and I have a theory. There are two types of people in this world. People who run away from things that scare them and people who run towards things that scare them. And I think people who like horror movies are in the latter category. But the good thing about a horror movie or, you know, like a roller coaster or a haunted house is that it's a controlled way to experience terrifying emotions with the knowledge that... you're not actually going to die. And so I think it's a way of exercising that natural impulse that a lot of people have to be fascinated by things that scare them. And you can experience it in a controlled way. And yeah, that's what I like about it. I actually find them really relaxing for that reason. Like, that's how I like to relax, is putting on horror movies. Because yeah, it's a controlled kick.
Exactly. I feel like people always are like, I don't understand how you relax or like fall asleep like watching horror movies. And I was like, I don't know, it's just discomforting.
It is.
I love that answer though, because I was recently talking with people about how there seems to be a couple different camps where there's people that like love horror movies, but they might hate haunted houses. You brought up like that kind of controlled thing where it's like, for some reason, for them being in that haunted house, even though it is controlled, it still is like less so than a horror movie. So some people get freaked out about that. And then there are people that like will refuse to play horror games, even though they're a huge horror file, because the idea of being actually in control of things like terrifies them of like things jumping out at them. So I always think that's interesting, because it seems like everyone has their own little kind of poison to do what you're talking about of like experiencing and kind of compartmentalizing horrors and understanding it in different ways.
Can I put forward a more risque version of this theory?
Oh, please do.
Okay. Horror movies, roller coasters, and kinky sex. If you're into one, you're into one of the other ones. I don't think anybody's into just one of those things.
Yeah.
Can't disagree.
Yep.
And speaking of controlled.
And roller coasters make me sick, so...
Oh my god! Who's got an air horn?
Let's talk about a kid's movie.
I'm sorry. It felt right.
Incredible.
It felt right.
No, like, I wouldn't. That's my air horn for you.
Yeah. Anyway.
Did horror movies scare you as a kid?
Yeah, but I was intrigued by that. You know, like I said, as part of my whole theory about running away from and running towards things that are scary to you.
And so conversely, I know that you said that you watch horror for comfort. Do you ever get scared at horror movies as an adult anymore?
Sometimes. I have
Can
a bad
you think
habit
of the last movie?
That actually like really freaked me out real bad was actually The Babadook, because I watched it not knowing anything about it. My coworker just handed me like they still made promo DVDs at that point. My coworker just handed it to me and he was like, here, you should watch this. And so I watched it like at midnight, like by myself in my apartment, and just like laid awake the whole night. I have a bad habit of watching ghost movies after midnight alone in my apartment.
Yeah, I did that a lot. Like when I was living in Chicago, when I was here for grad school, I just a lot of watching these like 1 a.m, all the lights off, like sound, like noise canceling headphones. Like, yeah, this is a good idea.
Well, I don't do the noise canceling headphones though, because my downstairs neighbor is a DJ, so I figure he owes me.
He does
fucking owe you. Jesus Christ.
It's fine. He doesn't do it too late at night, and he never bothers me about, you know, the screaming coming from my TV, so I think we're
you're definitely like got some you're on level ground there. You said you had a bad habit about something with horror movies as an adult or being scared of?
Oh, watching them late at night, like by myself in the house.
Yeah.
And it's specifically ghost movies that I think out of all of the things, I maybe believe in ghosts the most. And so that is the most real to me. Like, the movie Pulse scared the shit out of me, too. That's a scary movie.
Oh, that movie is fucking scary. Oh, I watched that recently and was like, absolutely fucking not. No, thank you. I hate it. I actually love that movie, but it's terrifying.
But it's so scary. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff that really freaks me out. Yeah. Like monsters and stuff, I'm fine, but
ghosts also terrify me. I've always been scared of ghosts as a kid. I don't really know where it came from necessarily, but like besides Catholicism, I just blame Catholicism on everything. but I've always been terrified of ghosts, and like I will always believe in ghosts. Like I know it sounds crazy pants, but like in the back of my head, I'm like, that shit could happen. I don't know, man. Like a ghost might be real. So that, yeah, I'm in the same camp with ghost stories.
It's not crazy. I think it's arrogant to think that you know what happens after you die, and ghosts are as plausible as anything else.
So what are you kind of hinted a little bit that you really like artsier horror, but so what are some of your favorite horror movies that have come out recently?
You know, I really like that. The other kind I like are like really gory, head exploding type of horror movies. That's the other
I love
kind
that. I
like.
Love the range. It's a good range. Yeah.
So I really like Possessor. That was one of my favorite movies last year.
Yeah, that movie fucking
rules.
That movie rules. How, like, If you didn't put that on your top 10, you're fooling yourself. I don't know. I thought it was great.
It was in my top two.
Hell yeah. So,
yeah.
So I really liked that one. It wasn't the first screening, but I saw Hereditary at the Overlook Film Festival, and they had managed to keep what it was about under wraps up to that point. And so that was just a really cool movie-going experience, you know, just watching that movie with no idea what it was. I thought it was going to be a creepy kid movie, but yeah, they had very successfully kept what it was about.
We all did.
Yes.
And then it happens, and you're like... What the fuck is this movie? Oh, wow. That was so cool. One of, like, the first people to see, like, one of the first groups to see it. Oh, shit.
Yeah, so it was cool. Pretty cool. Yeah. Gosh, I don't know. I watch a lot of movies because this year I covered Fantasia. I'm covering TIFF, and I'm covering Fantastic Fest remotely, sadly. But I will be covering it, so I think I've seen most of what's available.
Oh, my God. It's like so much going, like so many things. Did you like The Sadness, by the way? I'm just always, did you watch The Sadness?
God. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. That's the one that I want to talk to everyone about. And I know that Terry does too, because that movie's fucking insanity.
That movie's kind of nuts. And I kind of loved it. I kind of love just being like, what the fuck? For like an hour yes. and a half, you know? Speaking of mayhem, oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the vibe of that. And then, like, Malignant made me go, what the fuck, this year? So I'm like, I'm vibing with, like, the movies that, like, are kind of just, like, I don't know. Like, here's a bunch of really fucking wild shit. And you're like, this is what I need.
Oh, my God. Please. Two of my favorite movies in the whole wide world are Suspiria and House, the Japanese one.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm.
So, honestly, obviously, I'm up for anything, you know, when it comes to, like, what the fuckery. I'm up for anything. Like, that sounds great. I have not had a chance to watch Malignant yet. You should have seen me. I was covering TIFF remotely, sitting on my couch at home, being like, I've got to watch all these stupid fucking art movies. I can't even watch Malignant yet. Just, like, mad.
That, you know, honestly, I feel you, because last weekend I had to watch a movie for... Fantastic Fest. It was 2 hours and like 17 minutes. And I was like, no one has the time for this long of a screener.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. But so you mentioned, okay, covering lots of festivals. You're a writer, obviously. Mm-hmm. So why? Like, what inspired you to be a writer and write about horror movies? Like, what was your kind of journey into that?
Oh, gosh. Well, I always wrote stuff even when I was a little kid. Speaking of being a morbid little weirdo, I wrote a play for my third grade class that was about monsters going trick-or-treating. And then the whole thing was that, oh my God, they're real. They're not masks at the end of the play.
Aww.
I love that.
Yeah. I still have it somewhere. I still have the play that I wrote when I was like 8 about monsters.
Oh my God. That's incredible.
Somewhere. Awesome. I also got in trouble as a child because I wrote a ghost. Well, not really trouble, but my mom got called in to talk to my teacher because we had an assignment to write a ghost story. And I had written something super morbid. It was probably inspired by Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, you know? Like, it wasn't anything out of line. I think it was about, like, this ghost story about a woman who throws herself off a cliff on her wedding night or something. And, you know, and
standard genre fare, duh.
Like,
but, like, not even, like, in kids' stories, like, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Like, that shit I read when I was, like, too young. Yeah. But, yeah, like, that's not that wild.
It's not that wild. Like, at this point, I'd be like, oh, what a cliche. But apparently, my second grade teacher was concerned about the subject matter in the story and called my mom in for a meeting, and my mom told me, like, later as an adult about this and said, and I just told her you were like that.
That's just Katie.
Oh, don't worry about her. She's like fine. That.
Like, she's having a good time. She's just got some, like, she's just a spooky kid. It's fine.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit predestined that way. But, no, I had a lot of different jobs. I didn't go into being a professional writer straight out of college or anything like that. I had a lot of jobs. I was a PA for a while on TV show, and then I worked in a warehouse. I worked at a couple video stores. I taught English abroad. I toured with a comedy group. I did a lot of stuff.
Oh my God.
And then when I worked at a Doc Martens store. That was ridiculous. Like a hipster boutique is a ridiculous job. I don't know if you've read that. Yeah, you know about it, huh?
I can't even.
I know people, I know friends that have worked in one before, and it's something else.
Doc Martens was funny because they would have these like corporate training videos that were all like the spirit of independence and Doc Martens and being unique and, you know, fighting the man and blazing your own trail. But be sure to clock out for your breaks. You know, like it was stupid.
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
Independent, but also.
But also.
HR is like the manual. Yes, exactly.
Exactly. But also, if you're on time, then you're late. You know, arrive 5 minutes early. You're like, yeah, punk rock. Cool. So I was doing that. And then a friend of a friend who I went to college with was working at AV Club. And I was getting a little desperate to get out of this job. And so I was like trying to get just freelance ins anywhere I could. And so I did that. And I freelanced for them for about 8-9 months. Then they called me in for doing like a 6-month fellowship. And that went well. Okay. And I've been there ever since. So yeah, I didn't have I didn't get paid to write anything until I was 30. So if you're listening to this and you're not 30 yet, you're not behind. It's okay.
Everybody, if anything from this podcast, I feel like people should take away, it's that like everyone's writer journey is an absolute weird mishmash of like working 65 different jobs and not getting paid to write until like sadly too long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's no linear way to do this.
There really isn't. No, not at all.
No.
And I'm actually grateful for the life experience because I feel like it helps inform your writing. You know, you have a more varied perspective, I guess.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Okay, so this podcast that you co-host, Film Club, can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Oh, sure. So basically, all right, so here's the backstory here. They used to have a show called Film Club that was an Siskel and Ebert at the movies type of thing. And they started doing it because this guy I used to work with was on at the movies for a while after Ebert couldn't do it anymore. He was too sick. So they like picked people to come in and host some shows. And he hosted some shows. His name's Ignaty Vishnevetsky. So he left that. They ended up going with a different host for the next season. And then the show got canceled and he ended up at AV Club. And so the fact that he had been on TV before doing this, they wanted to do the same thing, but under the umbrella of the AV Club. So they called it Film Club. And then he ended up leaving the company and I joined up and took over on Film Club and we did it as video for a little while, but I never really liked doing the video so much. And so it was kind of a blessing when the pandemic came down and we started doing it as a podcast instead, because the whole thing is kind of based around one of my editors said to me one time, he was like, we really should just record you and AA Dowd's my co-host. And we really should just record you guys, you know, just bullshitting about movies in the office. And I was like, sure, sounds great. And so that was kind of the thought behind the show.
I love that. Just bullshitting. You're like, cool. That's all I want to do is just bullshit into a microphone about movies.
We do review episodes and we also do topics. Like we do some research on ours. It's not totally just yammering, but that was kind of the impetus was, people saying that they enjoyed listening to us talk in the office, which was very generous because, again, if you've worked in an open plan office, you know that that can be very annoying listening to other people talk. So I take that as a really big compliment that they wanted to start recording it.
Seriously. God. Because just thinking about all the other conversations I've heard going on in an open plan office, it's like, good Lord.
Yeah, I was like, so flattered, like, wow, you don't mind listening to me talk? That's so nice. Thank you.
You like me distracting you from your work? Good. Glad. I'm glad I can do that.
Yeah, happy to do so, right?
I know. And then, just like, I want to hear a little bit more about the work you've done with the Music Box Theater, which is like the best theater on the planet. I miss it all the time. So I know you've done a lot of really cool work with them for programming. So just like, want to hear a little bit more about what you do with them and all that good stuff.
Well, I started off programming with them. We had a festival there called Cinepocalypse for a few years, but that kind of dissipated in all the chaos of 2020 and, you know, all those festivals getting shut down and things like that. And so I said to Ryan, who's the GM at the theater, I said half as a joke to him, we should just do a drive-in festival instead. We should do like a dusk till dawn drive-in marathon instead of the festival that we were going to put on. And he was like, oh, ha ha ha. And then came back to me a few weeks later and was like, we should actually do that though. There was this, it's this place in Pilsen in Chicago. If you're familiar with Chicago, it's a neighborhood on the south side that's more kind of industrial, like the outskirts of it are very industrial. Mm-hmm. And so there was this space there where these people had an indoor soccer arena, and they were looking for a way to make money during the pandemic too. And so we joined up with them, and they turned their parking lot into a drive-in, and Music Box helped them by putting in some equipment and things like that. And we started putting on shows together there. And so last year we did 31 Nights of Terror, where every single night in October we showed a different horror movie at the drive-in.
So awesome.
We did another thing in at the end of May called Halloween, where we showed some movies. I showed Midsommar because it was it was seasonally appropriate for the time. Mm-hmm. It was on May Day. So
that was
That was a very funny joke just for me. And then yeah, and so then this year we're only going to do 30 nights at the drive-in because we're also going to do a 24-hour marathon at the theater. So we're on the drive-in on October 23rd because that's the 12 p.m. to 12 p.m. horror movie marathon. It's something like 60 movies or something we're showing this year. It's really ambitious.
Wow.
That's fucking crazy.
It's fun, though.
That's great.
No, it would 100%. It's so fun.
Yeah. I wish I lived in Chicago.
Oh, Chicago's the best. I miss Chicago with all of my soul.
Oh, it is pretty great.
I mean, it's not that far for me because, I mean, I live in Nebraska, so it's not terribly far.
I mean, if you want to come up for the weekend, you have my email.
I'm convinced that Chicago is the best horror city, but that's just me being biased and living there and finding a horror community in Chicago when I had never found one before, like where I live. So I think that might color my perception, but like,
yeah,
I met some fucking people in Chicago. Like, y'all are so cool.
You know what I like about people, audiences and horror audiences specifically in Chicago? Like, I enjoy the scene at things like Fantastic Fest, you know, where there is a lot of networking going on and stuff like that. But we don't really do that so much here. It really is more about just watching the movies. It's not so much about, like, you know, like seeing if someone can, you know, get you a professional connection or something like that. There's not that schmoozing aspect of it here so much.
Yeah.
So it really is about the love of the game in Chicago.
Yeah.
See, that's awesome because I hate the schmoozing aspect.
It is what it is. It's like a necessary part of the ecosystem, I think, but I'm glad to not have to deal with it regularly when I'm at home.
Let's do shots of Malort and just like talk about horror movies.
Yeah, yeah, hell yeah.
I had my first shot of Malort was at Cinepocalypse 2019.
Oh, man. Oh.
Try it someday.
I guess.
Yeah. I think so. I have a bottle of it in my bar because I'm a fucking wild person who, despite thinking it's disgusting, has to have it in my home.
Well, you know, I used to refuse to drink it, and you had to trick me into drinking it. Now I will drink it willingly. So, like, it's breaking me down over the years. I don't like it, but I will drink it. If you say, do you want to do a shot of Malort? I'll go, yeah, okay. When I used to be like, absolutely not. What's wrong with you? So it's breaking me down.
Next thing you know, it's Malort on the rocks.
Oh, I'm so sorry no. I said Why that. Did you do that to yourself? Oh, my God.
So how do you drink it? Is it just a shot?
Usually just a shot.
Usually just a shot, okay. Yeah.
You don't want to really.
It's like an extra funky aquavit. It's like aquavit drained through a dirty sock is basically what it tastes like.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's gross. Yeah.
It used to be you could only buy it here, but now when I travel, I see it at bars more often.
Well, and it's so weird. They had it at the liquor store here because apparently in Maryland, really? And Maryland's a weird fucking place where, like, we have random shit. But, like, apparently they really only sell Malort in liquor stores in here and in Chicago, which is so funny. I'm like, how the fuck do I live in the two places that sell Malort, like, readily?
My sister and my brother-in-law live in Portland, and I just give my brother-in-law's the type of person who likes to surprise people with a gross shot. So I just give him Malort for Christmas every year.
It's amazing.
It doesn't reflect my true feelings about him. He really does appreciate it.
Okay, so Malort aside, Katie, mm-hmm. what movie did you bring with you today for us to talk about?
Oh, I brought a movie that scared me worse than The Shining when I was a small child, which is Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
So for listeners who are unfamiliar, in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, a scientist father of a teenage boy and girl accidentally shrink his and two other neighborhood teens to the size of insects. Now the teens fight diminutive dangers as the father searches for them.
Gotta love IMDb and their really weirdly structured sentences sometimes.
Yes, it's incredible.
I love the alliteration on diminutive dangers. yes. You're not supposed to use too much alliteration in your writing or puns, but I say fuck that. They're both
I also
fun.
Say fuck that.
Fuck that.
I love alliteration. And I've had editors before be like, I hate this. And I'm like, I'm sorry. You can change it. But I love it so much.
I've had editors straight up be like, why are you doing this to me? And I'm like, I think it sounds good. And they're like, no.
Give us your horror story. I want to know how old you were when you saw this, how you saw this, what about it scared you, and why is this your scarred for life moment?
Oh, wow. Okay. I don't remember when I actually first saw the movie. I don't remember actually watching it, but I remember for probably a year or two afterwards, I had this kind of intense phobia that I was going to randomly shrink and fall through holes and things. So I refused to get on an escalator for like 2 years. I refused to walk over a sewer grate for like 2 years. I refused to take stairs that had holes between the slats for like 2 years because I was just terrified that I was going to shrink and fall through the hole, never to be seen again. And it was the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids that sparked this in me. And like, I used to hang out with my cousins a lot when I was little. And one of my cousins, my older cousin, he knew this. And he would scare me. He would just run in the room and yell, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids! And I would scream and be like, no! Oh. And then he'd run away and run out of the room, like, laughing. So he used to torment me with just yelling the title of the movie. I was so... There's something about... I can't psychoanalyze this. Like, if anybody's listening who's, like, a Freudian psychologist who knows why a little kid would be... would have this thing about shrinking. But yeah, like I was definitely looking down at the ground, like walking around any hole in the ground. I just refused to step over for a year or two because this movie.
That's amazing.
I love
it when a movie can like affect how you interact with the world, because like that was me with arachnophobia, where it was like, I realized different ways that I could be terrorized by a spider. And so that also changed the way I interacted with the world. So I love it when a movie affects someone so much that it's not just watching the movie and you don't really remember when you saw it. It's the after effects. I love hearing about those.
Yeah.
Makes me feel less of a freak.
No, not a freak at all. No. It's weird because I don't really remember when it went away either. I think just after a while it just went away. But I do the whole holes in the ground thing. There was like a grate in front of the door to the Kmart that we would go to buy groceries and shoes with Velcro 80s shoes and stuff like that. shout out to Velcro 80s shoes.
they were the best.
There was a grate in the floor, and it was just a sewer grate. It was just a storm grate that was in front of the door. And my mom used to have to pick me up and carry me over it, 'cause I would like thrash and scream and refuse to go into the Kmart 'cause I thought I would shrink.
That's amazing.
It's so weird. I can't explain any of this, but it is true. And it was like so traumatizing to me that I still think about it sometimes. Like if I'm walking down the street and I see a little hole in the sidewalk, I'm like, whoop, and I like jump over it.
So but the stairs without the backings, those scare me too. I remember being terrified of those as a kid, and I don't know why.
Because
triggered a memory in me.
I hate those fucking things because I had a friend who had stairs like that, and her brother would grab through the, like, it was like a slit foyer.
No!
So it was like a split foyer situation. So like you would go up and you could kind of like grab through. And so going up, he would like grab ankles and that fucking...
No, that's horrible. Like you drag you by your ankles to your doom. That's horrifying.
Yeah, it's like the most slasher shit ever of like getting your ass dragged down the stairs. Like, fuck that. So
that's a Conjuring movie, dude.
Yeah, it is a Conjuring movie. I fucking hated going to that house because of that goddamn reason. I was like, a goddamn hand is going to come out and like
grab me and pull me down into the basement. Ah!
Anyway, so I guess Terry, yeah, you also just fucking triggered that in my head. I'm just like, oh my God. There you go. Death.
So your fear seems to be a little bit more existential about this film in terms of, because like I was, whenever I watch a movie that a guest picks, I'm always like, okay, what is the scene that traumatized them? And so I had a couple that could have potentially been that, but I wasn't prepared for this more existential kind of real world dread about shrinking and floating away or getting sucked into a hole.
I can't explain it except to explain it in sort of the larger terms of something that I thought about when I watched the movie again as an adult, which mm-hmm. is that this is a movie. A lot of movies from the 80s are kind of about this. And I was a latchkey kid, so I was left home alone a lot. And this is, I would call Honey, I Shrunk the Kids part of that latchkey cinema, which is like movies that are made for kids that are about bad things that can happen when your parents aren't home.
My worst fucking, I hate that fucking genre of movie because I was such an anxious kid and like that was like always scared the shit out of me. Like what happens when your parents aren't home? But yeah.
And it's a total genre though, right? Like yes. during, and in the 90s too, it carried through into the mm-hmm. 90s.
But The Gate makes me think of that too. Like whenever yeah. we talk about that, The Gate's one of the first ones that pops into my head that we watched for this podcast actually.
Yeah. But
there was that fear, because, like, I wasn't a latchkey kid necessarily, but, like, there were, my mom and my brothers had to go to doctor's appointments a lot, so I was home alone, like, after school, and I was always so excited to, like, watch The X-Files and stuff like that. But then movies like this were like, I want my mom to be home. I don't like being alone. Like, I can't be yeah. trusted around any appliance, like, any machinery. Like, I don't know what's going to happen to me. Yes.
I'm gonna, 100%. Like, set the house on fire if I try to, like, microwave some popcorn or something. Yeah. All those fears. And I think it all kind of ties in with that idea of like something that is in the movie, which is like being neglected by your parents until they just okay. don't see you at all anymore and you just kind of disappear. Like that's like fucked. An existential childhood fear that kind of ties in to this thing that we're talking yes. about of latchkey cinema.
Yes. I totally that okay, I remember seeing this movie actually in the movie theater. This was one of the first times that I went to go see a movie in a movie theater. My grandparents took me. They came up from like the continental United States because we lived in Alaska at the time, and they drove everywhere, and so they drove up to see us. They spent like a few weeks, and one of the things we went to do is my grandparents took me to go see this movie. And I remember seeing the movie theater. I remember that it opened up with Tummy Trouble, the Roger yes. Rabbit short. Animated short, and I remember seeing that and being like, oh, I love Roger Rabbit, and then thinking that all movies should have like a Roger Rabbit short in front of it. But I, you know, I totally did not remember any of this parent stuff. I just was more enraptured in like the kids stuff. But the parent stuff is actually frankly traumatic. This and on both sides, because you have Selinsky, who is completely ignoring his son, who is obviously looking up to him with so much like love and affection and wants to be his father with like making that sort of model laser and stuff. And you have him just being completely swept away as mm-hmm. he literally happens to him later. And then you have on the other side, the Thompsons and their kid about with this like discussion of masculinity where, you know, the kid is, he's not big enough. He's not into sports. He's not into fishing. He needs to be fixed. We need to buff him up. We need to make a man out of him. And so there's all of that kind of existential stuff in here that as a kid, I completely went over my head.
Yeah. And you're right to point out that whole subplot with them trying to toughen him up and make him more, you know, quote unquote masculine, because that's another way that you can feel like people don't see you. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you can shrink down until you aren't there anymore, as if you don't fit the norms.
Right.
And I also latched on a lot more to this, that like the quasi-divorce plot going on in this, with the mom, like, going away, because I I'm a child of divorce, and also my mom and my stepdad fought a lot when I was a kid. So, like, this definitely suck in my head that way of, like, when you're a kid and your parents are fighting all the time, how small you feel. Like, you can't, you want so badly to fix it and find a way to make your parents, like, be whole again. But the more you try to, like, fix that, I think the smaller you feel. And so that I also really stuck out in terms of, like, these two kids who are trying, like, the daughter especially is, like, trying to keep it together and, like, be cool for her parents and, like, for her brother. And she just, like, slowly kind of, again, like, she shrinks down and fades away.
Well, and this is another trope that I think a lot of movies kind of in this ilk kind of do, where the kids end up taking over the slack of the parents, the inattentive parents, because you have her cooking and failing, like, just burning the shit out of her toast and stuff. But, like, you have her kind of taking on a more parental unit or parental role than her parents do, and having to, like, ping her father, you know, it's breakfast. I love that little detail where there's multiple signs that she has to push for, like, it's breakfast time, it's dinner time, as if he has no concept of time, so that it's almost as if this, like, announcement is like, hey, it's time for breakfast. And so the kids have to take on the parenting roles, and it's really sad.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, we all had these different life experiences, but they all connect to that feeling of being small, and that ties into the movie. So it really is, I suppose, a feeling that a lot of kids can relate to.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this watching this, because this is probably the first time, maybe since the movie theater. I mean, I probably saw it a little bit after that, but, like, that is the only time I remember seeing this film. But I do remember, because I would have been, it came out in 89, so I would have been 8 when I saw this movie. And, you know, looking back on it now, I started laughing to myself as I was watching it. I was like, last night, because I was so enraptured with Little Russ, like, I should have realized then that I was queer. But, like, as I started watching the movie more, I was like, no, I don't know. And this is sort of something that I think a lot of queer kids kind of deal with, is, do I want to be him or do I like him? You know what I mean? So, like, as I started watching this as an adult, I was like, I think maybe what actually drew me to the character is, like, he, like, resonated with me with this sort of, like, father who wants him to be masculine. So I remember the time that my dad took me out to in the yard and was like, we're going to throw a football, we're going to toughen you up, we're going to make you, you know, you're going to want to do foot, you're going to want to join the football team. And I was like, gosh, it must have been in fifth grade at the time. And I had no desire to do any of these, like, masculine, I'm using quotation marks for listeners, type of roles. And yet everyone wanted me to be this sort of, like, because I was built bigger and, you know, and, oh, you gotta go out for the sports. You'd be a great tackler and all this kind of stuff. And it was like this push to do that. And so, like, I think looking back on it, that I probably saw myself in this kid who wanted nothing to do with fishing, because fishing was huge in Alaska. And I wanted nothing to do with sports, wanted nothing to do with the traditional masculine roles.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I mean, I don't love that you went through that, but I'm glad you had that identification.
Yeah, it was such a weird moment watching this last night. I was like, whoa, because at first I was, again, chuckling. I was like, oh, yeah, I thought this kid was cute. And now as an adult, I think the father is kind of cute. But I was like,
hey, there's nothing wrong with Rick Moranis.
Oh, no, I mean the other one.
Oh, the other one.
I love Rick Moranis.
I think Matt Frewer. Who I was like, where have I seen him before? And he was in Orphan Black. He's a scientist in Orphan Black.
Oh,
I
don't know, really? If you've
watched that. Yeah. Aldous Leakey or whatever. Huh. He's the scientist in that. But yeah. So it was such a weird moment of, like, whoa, things are kind of, like, connecting.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the dads too, because something that was really funny with the dads is, like, how goofy they were though. Like, they were so, like, the neighbor was like, oh, we have to have you be, like, this particular way and go fishing and be masculine. And then Rick Moranis' character is such a nerd and, like, has a very specific way of doing things. But they're also huge goofballs, like slapstick comedy all over the place, which is so funny, because, like, you have these two characters being like, this is, like, especially the neighbor, like, more like masculinity. But also he stabs himself in the finger with the fish hook and is always doing something kind of silly with his body. And so is Rick Moranis. But I always think of Rick Moranis as slapstick, though. Like, that man's body is just like a noodle. Mm-hmm. But, like, he is a scientist and is, like, a very serious scientist. And then you see him do these hilarious things. And it's just such a funny contrast between these two men who like want to be very serious and like very taken seriously, and then they're absolute like unable to kind of control their own bodies in a way. Oh, a friend,
Kitty.
Yeah, you can't see it on the podcast, but my cat likes to. She is always very curious about what we're doing.
Is with she the headphones making biscuits on your neck?
Yeah, she's making biscuits. It's biscuit time. Oh my
god. What is her name?
I love her.
Her name is Loretta Lynn the cat. Because, she was, the shelter she came from was in Louisville, Kentucky. And they found her when she was just a sweet little baby kitten. And she was pregnant. So she was a teenage mom from Kentucky, just like Loretta Lynn, who I love. So that's why.
That is such a sweet story.
Oh, yeah. Girl, she loves you so much.
She's so adorable.
It's my little teen mom.
She matches your sweater too, which is very good.
Oh yeah, thank you.
Anyway.
Yeah, so please don't mind Miss Loretta. She'll just hang out with us for a little while.
Hell yeah. That's all I want.
But with your point, Mary Beth, though, what kind of just clicked in my mind too is that yes, you have two different sides. You have like this guy that's super masculine and wants his son to be super masculine, and then you have the scientist who's very smart, and none of their kids are living up to their expectations in a way. Like they're both invisible to them for completely different reasons, even though they are like sort of in the same realm as their father. They're both being completely ignored by their father.
God damn, this movie is way sadder than I remember it. Literally watching this movie, all I remembered was giant ant fight in grass and pollen. And then I watch it, I'm like, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Well, and I was thinking about this, like, wow, the things we watched as kids that were made for kids, but so obviously also made for adults. Like, they wrote these really smart movies. And get older and revisit things I loved as a kid, I think I'm getting a much deeper appreciation for writers, like script writers, and their abilities to like do this really cool balancing act between funny and like relatable for kids and also like funny for adults. Like it's just a really cool, it's so cool to see those movies, like how they balance that. And the things like that I remember as a kid and did not remember as a kid to what I look at now. And it's just like, it's really, really skillful, like cool to watch that like skill and what those writers are able to do and like how they're able to make such complicated stories that you love and have scarred you, but also like make you feel a lot of things about being a child and growing up.
And you know, this one in terms of the writing has a really interesting backstory. This one, I mean, if it feels like a horror movie for kids, that's because it is. It was written, the original story was written by Stuart Gordon and Brian Usna. Stuart Gordon was originally supposed to direct the movie, and they had gotten pretty deep into pre-production when he had to drop out of the production for a medical reason. I don't know if it was a heart attack or an aneurysm or something like that, but he had like a medical reason why he had to drop out of the production because working with Disney was stressing him out too much. You know, because you know,
that shit hasn't fucking changed in decades.
Yeah, because you know, most of Stuart Gordon's more famous movies are like more independent productions; they're not studio films, and so I guess he just wasn't suited for the studio environment. And so Stuart Gordon ended up leaving the project, and a guy named Joe Johnston ended up taking it over, and he was an effects guy who had worked on Star Wars, and he had worked on the Raiders movies, and he had worked on Willow. And so they gave this to him as like his directorial debut. And, you know, unlike Stuart Gordon, who was not made for this Disney life, Joe Johnston made a lot of movies for Disney. Have you done any episodes about Jumanji? I feel like that would be a traumatic.
I am surprised it has not come up yet.
And I need to, because that was a movie that like was very, very like important for me as a child. But yes,
but yeah, he's the studio guy. He made The Rocketeer, he made The Pagemaster, Jumanji, Jurassic Park 3.
Right.
Incredible. But,
all be winners.
But yeah, I think it's, you know, it's really interesting to me to think about the collision of these two worlds, you know, like the kind of 80s indie horror world with the Disney kids machine. And, you know, at the time, Disney had yet to go through its 90s revival. And so they were, I think they were a little hard up for ideas. And so they decided to take a big swing with these two.
I mean, this has been a trend because we've covered a couple of Disney movies on the show. And this has been a trend with like Something Wicked This Way Comes and some other, you know, Disney Watcher in the Woods, where they hire someone involved in the horror genre that is making like classical type horror films. I mean, I guess you probably couldn't call Reanimator like a classical type horror film, but like these horror films that like are, you know, the more, I guess we'd call it, well, some people would call it today elevated, like gosh, what is that Donald Sutherland movie? Don't Look Now.
Yeah, Don't Look Now.
Hiring that to write, like, all these highfalutin horror directors coming in to do kids movies, and they do it with respect to the kids as opposed to just making like a dumbed down kids movie. They do things that could be like a horror movie, but it just happens to be for kids. And I think you can definitely see that in some of the sequences in this film too.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as far as 80s horror director go, you know, if you just change the subject matter, obviously, like Reanimator is not for children. But I mean, Stuart Gordon's style, it's very colorful, it's very campy, it's very fun. Mm-hmm. I think that could translate into the kids realm pretty well.
Right. It surprises me that Brian Yuzna, I mean, this the society director, is writing a kids movie. Well, I think that's just phenomenal.
He also made that movie Dolls, which is like a spooky doll movie, which is, you know.
I love Dolls. That movie's incredible.
Yeah, Dolls is awesome. But, you know, that's sort of tiptoeing towards kids territory a little bit.
Dolls is definitely has, like, it's more horror than kid, but that's a weird one where you're like, ooh, it's almost a kid's movie, but well, and it's like, I think, Terry, you said this, but like, they respect kids as audience members. Like, it's not thinking that kids are dumb and need like bright colors and like silly shit for silly shit. It's bright colors and silly shit because they can handle it and can like kind of understand what's happening in terms of like monsters and creepy stuff. Like, I love that because horror directors seem much more respectful of, like, in general, this is obviously a generalization, but like understanding that kids are smart. Kids are not stupid. And kids are able to understand the world much better than a lot of people give credit for.
And a lot of people's fears, you know, a lot of fears are childhood is very scary. You know, you're just trying to figure out the world and how it works and you don't have any power. Childhood can be a scary time.
Yeah, the more we on this podcast, the more we talk about childhood, the more I do realize how fucking scary being a kid is. Like, I knew it was scary, but the more we talk about it, I'm like, damn, being a kid is just, like, the most anxiety-inducing experience. At least for a kid like me, who was, like, scared of a lot of stuff and a lot of anxiety, but, like, good Lord. Good Lord. It's not much better as an adult, but it's, like, a little bit better as an adult. Yeah. It's, like, a little bit better. Like, a little bit more of a grasp on things, kind of.
And, well, another, you know, talking about, like, the ordinary day-to-day terrors of childhood, you were talking about some of the big sequences in this movie. They all involve, you know, kind of, like, normal household things. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. You know which sequence really freaked me out when I was a kid was the one where Rick Moranis almost eats his son?
Scene?
Existential terror!
That scene, like, even the part where, like, he's in the milk and he puts the spoon in and eats, and you're like, did he eat him? I knew he didn't, right. But when I watched it this time, I was like, he ate his son? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yes! And, like, I also, in my head, was thinking about what an incredible thing to set up a giant bowl of Cheerios, like, have the practical effect of having this kid swimming in milk in a bowl of Cheerios. And, like, the way they play with scale in this movie is just so fucking cool.
Yeah.
What I remember when I was rewatching this is how much I wanted to be those shrunken kids. Like, when they're being pelted by rain, I mean, it's supposed to be a horrifying moment, but I was like, oh my God, that looks so cool. Or when they find the giant oatmeal cookie, I was like, oh, can you imagine coming across this giant oatmeal cookie and just having frosting? Like, these are the thoughts that I was as a kid. This movie didn't terrify me as a kid at all because I was like, this is so cool. Can't I have this? When they go down the slide out of the trash can and it's like this, the grass leaf and they're going down to the ground. I'm like, this is so much fun.
Those are the memories. The moment that really did, it gave me a new appreciation for bugs was the ant and understanding what ants really looked like. I don't think I really knew, like, conceptually what an ant up close looked like. Like, I knew what it looked like, but the face and the hairiness, mm-hmm. no concept of this as a child. None. And so
it taught me how hairy insects are.
Right? And then along with that, the sound it makes, I was like, I was scared to kill ants for a while. Because I was like, they make noises. Like, it, oh. And like, I was
just like, oh, that's so sweet.
They're real animals. Like, they're not just ants. They're real animals. And I think that that's what my big takeaway from this movie was, that moment of just being like, oh, wait. Oh, it's an individual. And I think that kind of fucked me up, and thinking about like how tiny things are and how they really do matter. Mm-hmm. And that fuck, that got me all kinds of weird fucked up as a kid. I was just like,
yeah, that's the kind of overwhelming thought. Like, when you're a kid, you're like, oh my God, there are,
and like, you can't conceptualize
so many living things.
Like, and it's like hard for you to conceptualize it out loud. So you're just like full of this anxiety. Like, I can't kill that fucking ant. That ant's got a family.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yes. Oh, my like, God. That moment with the ant, and then them feeding the ant, and then fighting the scorpion, I was just, that really fucked me up. Because, again, like, it was like the ant became like a dog or a pet. And I was like, I don't like that, like the loss we're experiencing here with this bond they have with this animal. Because, like, the dog Quark is like a figure in this movie, and it's almost like the ant becomes Quark in like a way for a bit. So it's like, oh, that's the pet, that's like the comfort animal, the help, like it can help. And then he gets got by the scorpion, and they couldn't get to him in time to save him.
Yeah. So vicious.
And it's just so
it
vicious.
Is traumatic. That is, there are a lot of traumatic elements in this movie, aren't there? Oh man.
Side note though, Katie, I am so thankful that you brought a movie about shrinking people and large insects that does not have a fucking spider in it.
Well, I didn't know about the spider thing, so that's just good luck.
Because when I was about to ready to watch this movie, I was like, I remember there's an ant. Remember, the ant gets killed by something. I can't remember, is there a spider in this movie? And I was prepared the entire time for this giant spider to come on the scene, because I honestly could not remember. And it's become like kind of a trope on this podcast, where we'll be watching something and there'll be a surprise tarantula or a surprise spider. And it's like, I was not prepared for this. And like, so I was sitting here this entire time almost on pins and needles, like, is there a spider? Wait, I cannot remember. I should have went to Wikipedia.
It would have fit, wouldn't it?
I mean, you know, this movie is taking, you know, it's pulling from like the Incredible Shrinking Man.
Absolutely.
And a bunch of those movies from like the 50s where they used giant spiders in those movies. And so it would have perfectly fit. I was so happy it was a scorpion, because scorpions don't bother me. Other than that, I don't want to be stung by one.
Made me also realize, like, can fucking scorpions be in my backyard? Like, that was another thing that, like, I never saw scorpions. I'm like, is there a scorpion in my suburban backyard neighborhood?
Yeah, this is a good question. where I'm from, we had black widows. Yeah, we had those where I was from. You had to be careful. Like, if you went camping, you had to check the toilet.
Yep, toilet shoes. We had that. Yep. We had them living up. We had like a colony in our garage. We weren't allowed in the garage.
Oh my God! Wow, I never came up that close. I just remember being at Girl Scout camp and, like, you know, peeking into the toilet, like, oh, is there gonna be a black widow?
Oh God! Girl Scout camp, getting the latrine, making sure a spider wasn't gonna bite your ass. Sorry, Terry. I'm so sorry.
Sorry, Terry. We're re-traumatizing Terry.
Yeah, my stepdad would be like, "Oh, look, there's a black widow," and we had like them in our garage. We lived in the woods, basically. So we had a lot of critters that just, like,
were like, lots of spiders.
You're in our woods. And I was like, I guess you're right. Where did you grow
up,
Katie?
Brown recluses also, I remember hearing. Be careful, though.
Oh, God, those. Yeah.
Katie, where did you grow up?
In Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay. I'm in Maryland, so it's not too far. I feel like we have, like, similar critter situations.
Yeah, no, other side of the mountains, basically.
Yeah,
you know?
Basically.
Yeah, but one thing, so I wrote an article about how I was traumatized by this movie for AV Club a few years ago, and I did a little bit of research for it. And one thing that I really loved was that, I mean, obviously they really built all this stuff, but they built it in this, they had this gigantic soundstage in Mexico City where they built all of these sets. And so kind of the story is, while Stuart Gordon is off being traumatized by having to work with Jeffrey Katzenberg back in L.A., Brian Usna is down in Mexico City, like, supervising the creation of all these, like, 10-foot tall blades of grass and stuff and just having a great time.
Fuck yeah. That giant flower full of pollen that I always wanted to jump into.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that is like, the sets are so cool. I'm like, can I go visit them now? Like, are they still around? Like, are they a thing that you can go see?
I don't know. Do you remember though? I never went, but I remember seeing commercials when I was a kid and being freaked out by them. But they had like a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids like area at Disneyland or something like that.
Yes, they did. I do remember that, and I
did not want to go.
Did I want to go? I cannot fucking remember if I remember seeing that, because I also, this movie, I also conflate this one with Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, because mm-hmm. I was born in 93. So that one was like, I was like more cognizant of the world ish for strong wording. But like when it came out on like VHS, I remember watching that movie, and I remember like watching all of the, there was like on the VHS, I feel like there were a lot of ads for the movie when it was coming out, but also like a feature, I feel like there was like a featurette in my head that I remember about it, and that was always stuck in my head. Yeah,
there probably was for the effects, I imagine. Yeah,
exactly. And so like this movie has always, like, no matter if it was like the third one or the first one, like the effects have always been kind of cemented in my head as something that, like, it looked like a playground. Like it did look like something I wanted to play in. Like, oh shit, like, this is a really cool concept for a playground or a theme park. And I think that the more I say it, the more I'm like, I think I did remember wanting to go to Disney to like play in that area.
Yeah. It was at, Epcot Center was where they had the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids space. Yeah. We never actually went, but what's funny about it is a big, fun, fantastical playground for children where you might also die.
That's always the best, right? That's always the best playground. Well,
and then there's the part where
with some danger.
Yeah, and where they almost drown. That was another scary part of this movie. Yeah.
Watching that scene as an adult now, it reminded me of the Poltergeist scene at the very end where she gets stuck in the pool with the corpses and the coffins and stuff, because it has that gross kind of dirty water look to it.
Something about dirty water that's just unsettling. I guess because you don't know what's in there, you know?
Right. Okay. There's some adult humor in this too that I really appreciate. And I'm bringing this up because we had talked about the bear scene in The Shining and asking the parents and being like, don't worry about it. I remember asking my grandparents, what is it about French class and CPR?
Oh.
And my grandparents being like, ask your parents. And so I did ask my parents, and they said, we'll tell you when you're an adult. Because I was 8 years old, and there's the French kissing joke, right?
That's a mild joke, too. I mean,
I know it is, but that's my parents.
But the ending is, he goes, French class, with his little bow tie and his like his little nerdy mullet and his roll, and I was like, I love you so, like, what a great character, you're so cute. But it was just a very cute little note to end on.
But I didn't get it, Nick. I didn't get it.
But yeah,
you might have, Nick.
Like, again, there is a lot of like adult adjacent humor in this, on top of the adult Diane themes. Saying,
right, and Diane saying, Amy. In the dark with little Russ Thompson, they'd better behave themselves.
I love that, like, we're tiny, so we're going to bone when we're tiny. Like,
I guess all bets are off, I guess.
I guess teenage boy, I guess people don't, like, as teenage people assume teenage, the worst of teenage boys, which is probably.
Which they probably should
though. Like, let's be real.
But then also, Russ trying to slide into Amy's DMs with, like, do you think you will be warm enough? I'm like, boy. Nice try. So you kind of mentioned, Mary Beth, a little bit that when you saw this, but how did you see this movie?
I could not fucking tell you how I saw this movie. It's again, one of those movies that is just in my brain. And I knew I watched it on VHS, and I loved it, and I watched it a lot. but like I could not tell you the exact experience of when I first saw it. Like I just know that it was a big part of my childhood. Both this and Honey, we shrunk ourselves. And I don't know why the second one just like didn't register in my brain whatsoever. Just one and three are the ones that I remember. But yeah, they're just like a movie that I watched all the time. And I think I just like wore out the VHS mm-hmm. tape kind of situation. Like, yeah, because I was trying to think about it. I was like, I know I saw this movie a ton as a kid, but like I could not tell you the exact moment of which it happened. It was just like the, one of the movies we always like to watch as a family.
Yeah. it was a big hit. It was around a lot in like the early 90s, you know, and mm-hmm. they did have that Epcot Play Space and they did make the sequels. I remember sitting in a movie theater and they played the trailer for the second one for Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. And I remember being so proud of myself that I wasn't scared. Big things aren't scary, I guess. Just little ones.
Can't fall through the grate when you're a big thing.
Nope. Nobody misses you when you're 30 feet tall, I guess, you know.
No one can eat you. Well, your parent mm-hmm. can't accidentally eat you in a bowl of cereal. Yeah,
your dad can't accidentally eat you. There's something about that that is so dark.
It's so dark.
It's so dark. Like,
and then, like, you think about like some of the weird shit on the internet from people like Vore, and then you think about that. Because I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. I thought about Vore.
No, I get it though, but it's like it's a dad and a kid, so that's extra fucked up.
It's fucking weird, and he's like dad and splashing around in the cereal.
Yes, and he can't hear him.
Just the power dynamic thing. Don't think about it too hard, but now I am, and I'm just like, oh, it's just like it's gross. Like
it is. It's weird. It's gross. It's dark. It's Stuart Gordon and Brian Usna, man. You know.
But would he chew him, or would he just swallow him? And like, would he? I'm sorry.
Probably just swallow him whole.
Yeah, because he's so tiny. And
Yeah. Oh. But it's just so interesting to me how, like, it's presented in this really cartoony, upbeat, it's supposed to be a comedy. It's not supposed to be even a kid's horror movie. It's supposed to be a comedy. And it's presented in this bright, cheerful, fun way. But, yeah, when you think about it, the idea of screaming for your dad to help you and he doesn't hear you, but he eats you instead? Dude. That's like a Goya painting. That's like really, really dark.
I mean, I think that's the Usna and the, you know, Stuart Gordon popping in like a little bit of their darkness, just interjecting that with a couple of those scenes. And that is definitely that moment that it's mm-hmm. like, wow, I forgot about that scene until I was rewatching it. I was like, oh yeah, this is.
That's the other one that really stuck out in my head of like the kid getting eaten by his parent. Like that fucking freaked me out of just like the parent unknowingly and enacting harm upon you, which like goes back to what we're talking about, like latchkey kids and like fading mm-hmm. away and like not having any kind of importance and your parents just forgetting and neglecting you. And like, think you're so small and like you're so inconsequential that your parent just eats you and doesn't like think of anything about it.
Ew. Doesn't even think about it. Yeah.
Sorry I said that. Ooh, girl, gross. But again, like it's so funny. Like you want to laugh. Like, oh, he's in a bowl of Cheerios. Like everyone eats Cheerios.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's so funny and upbeat and like look at him in the giant Cheerio bowl. And then you're like a split second of extra thought. You're like, oh wait. Oh God. Yes. Ugh.
I think that's probably the darkest moment in the movie. Like, there are other parts that are scary. Their whole trip through the backyard is scary. There's a lot of, like, monster movie kind of stuff going on there. And them almost drowning was scary, too. But I think, personally, that his dad almost eating him is the most fucked up part of the movie. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Would you guys agree?
Oh, yeah. Because I was trying to think of the moments. And I think, thrilling wise, like the mower part,
yeah,
where it's like parked over the wormhole and they're getting like almost sucked up into it. I was like, that's thrilling, but that's not, I mean, it goes along with the sort of monster movie aspect mm-hmm. of it. But then that moment at the very end, yes, I completely agree. That is like the tying into the thematic area. That is the synthesis of this movie, where it's like the father is so ignorant and so oblivious about his kid that he might eat him mm-hmm. or throw him away, brush him up and throw him out and take him out to the trash. Like these images, that is like the perfect encapsulation of the fears that kid has. And it's very fucking dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for like sure. we were saying before, you know, if you're a kid who feels small or forgotten mm-hmm. for any number of reasons, then that like really hits you. It really hits you in a really direct way. Great job. I mean, I know that like, and there was another writer, Ed Naha, who had worked with Gordon and Yuzna before, who helped write the script. I think it was originally called The Teeny Weenies was the original title of the script.
Teeny Weenies! Yeah.
And then they changed it to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So he worked on the script also. And then obviously Joe Johnston ended up directing it. But I really do kind of think of this as a Stuart Gordon, Brian Yuzna movie.
Oh, same. Absolutely same.
I did not know that they actually were involved. That is so cool.
Yeah. It made so much sense. Like, as an adult looking it up and reading all the names, I was like, oh, I get that. That's why it's horror, guys, that made it. Of course it freaked me out so bad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's so interesting that they changed it from the Teeny Weenies to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, because it feels like such the dad being like, honey, I fucked up kind of thing. Like, it's that really, it's got that vibe of like the dad did something very wrong. And like, I know honey isn't necessarily gendered, but you kind of get the idea. In your head, you're like, it's the dad saying, honey, I shrunk the kids. And it like has that more vibe of like, oh, the parent did something fucked up to the kid rather than the teeny weenies, yeah. which sounds kind of, is cute. It's like, oh, they're fun. They're like going on an adventure in the backyard.
Yeah,
rather than
totally.
Dad's fucking weird experiment in the attic. Like, turning yeah. the kids into tiny.
My dad being caught up in his work is going to kill me. I'm literally going to die.
literally. But also, like, I just like, is that normal for your parents to have these, like, crazy-ass projects in their house? Because my stepdad did a lot of construction stuff. And, like, not this level, but, like, he was always out in his shed. And, like, I learned he's out instead of smoking weed, not just building things, as I was older. Mm. Like, learned that, which is hysterical. But I was like, is my stepdad like that? Like, is he building a project in the shed? He's smoking weed. But that's okay. Like, that's totally fine. But it was just made me laugh. I was like, does everyone's parent have a fun project they work on in secret?
You know, I was thinking about that, rewatching this. I was like, the house kind of reminded me a little bit of the Gremlins, where the father in that is, you know, making all these bizarre inventions that, you know, end up exploding in his face or whatever. But it reminded me that as a kid, I was like, man, I really wanted to have that elaborate coffee maker that was in this place, or like that notification system, or the stuff in the Gremlins. Like, I wanted to live in that kind of techie house, and I didn't.
And they added in Back to the Future too.
Yeah.
They had those kind of, I think, what are they called? Like a Rube Goldberg device, where it's a really elaborate device to do a simple thing.
To do simple things.
Those were kind of big in 80s movies, that kind of like elaborate device thing.
Yeah. Because
Pee-wee's Big Adventure also has one of those in it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Kids movies and those things, definitely. It seemed like that was like a trope of the 80s for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted a dog that could get the newspaper. And I thought it was that easy. And guess what? It's fucking not.
I love little Mary Beth. She's
so
sweet.
I had a lot of thoughts. I had a lot of dreams about, especially animals. I was like, I can teach our labs to fetch the newspaper. No, our labs were like lovable idiots. They were great. But I was like, oh yeah, a dog could totally grab the newspaper. Like, we could get like Casey to go get to the newspaper. No fucking way that ever going to happen. But like, in my head, I was like, this is the ideal neighborhood. And it kind of looks like, it's got that like kind of like 50s era, like ish vibe to like this very like constructed set. But I was like, I want that too. I want my dog to fetch the newspaper.
Yeah.
I've never once met a dog that actually fetches the newspaper.
I'm sure someone has, and if they haven't, they really should already. Oh, well, I was going to say, if no one's yet, here's a free idea for a thesis about the role of the suburbs in 80s horror comedies. Because that was like a big theme in 80s horror comedies too. And I think it might have something to do with the fact that a lot of these guys that we're talking about who were working on these films grew up in the 50s, and there was like that, you had two things going on. You know, you had the rise of suburbia, and you also had monster movies, you know, like Roger Corman, kind of black and white drive-in monster movies were big at the same time. And I think you definitely see those impulses come together here, and also in the work of Joe Dante, speaking of Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Dante's Gremlins and Poltergeist and all of those type of, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I also do want to give a shout out to James Horner, who created the soundtrack of my childhood. I'm like looking through, because he did he was the composer for this, and I was looking through the movies that he did, like Krull and, you know, the Star Trek movies and Cocoon and Commando and Aliens and all these movies that I grew up, American Tail, you know, Batteries Not Included, Willow, like all these films.
Wow, that's a range.
That yeah. I grew up watching, and I love his music. I've always loved his music. And it just reminded me of all of the times that I would like listen to movie soundtracks, and a lot of the ones that I would buy, particularly when I was a teenager, were James Horner. I mean, of course, Titanic. Mm. I had the sheet music to that, and I was playing Duh. That on the piano.
I love Young Terry, too.
I was such a nerd. I have, like, so many piano books from when I was, like, a 17-year-old, 16-year-old.
Did playing, you sing, like, though? Like, did you sing My Heart Will Go On? Did you play it on the piano and sing it?
So I did when my parents weren't home.
Hell yeah.
I was so embarrassed about, like, my singing ability. So, like, I would, the moment the house was to myself, my parents were running an errand or whatever, I was bringing out the Phantom of the Opera. I was bringing out Titanic. I was bringing out all of this shit and just pounding the shit out of my dad's baby grand piano, because he had a baby grand because he was in the band, in the military, and all this kind of stuff. So, like, I was pounding the shit out of this piano and singing like nobody was watching.
Oh, yes. Incredible. Love it. Oh, I love that
so much.
I was into Phantom of the Opera when I was a kid, too.
Yep, Phantom of the Opera, yeah. Jekyll and Hyde, like those kind of dark horror-ish like musicals. Mm-hmm. I was a huge, huge fan of, and could play all the music.
Wow, that brings my heart a lot of joy. Imagine you doing that.
I want to be friends with little Mary Beth and little Terry. Call Rick Moranis and be like, "Hey, bud, can you make us a time machine this time?" We were.
Honey, you sent Katie back in time to hang out with the podcast hosts when they were babies.
Oh, please! I was kind of a lonely child. I would have been so happy to have friends like you guys.
I was too. So I was pounding the shit out of a piano.
Yeah.
I had a worm farm where I named all the worms.
Did you really?
Amazing. Incredible. I love it.
I had like a bucket full of dirt, and I had all the worms, and I would name one of them the mom and one of them was dad, and they all had names. And then my stepdad dumped it out because he said it wasn't humane to have them in the bucket. It was so sad because of my worm farm. I was fucking weird, guys. It's fine. We were all weird as kids. It's okay. Cool.
I also had a weird phase where I was really into the Salem witch trials. When I was like a child, I would read every book I could find. Mm-hmm. I was like this little 10-year-old being like, I could name all the, you know, people hung for witchcraft. And I was like, actually, Giles Corey was crushed between two stones. He was not hung. And I was like 10 years old. I was a weirdo. Like,
I love this. We've been such great friends.
I know. Wow. We can sing Phantom and play with the worms.
And talk about witch trials. Because I definitely read. I was not as obsessed. Like, I loved it. I read a lot about the witch trials and, like, convinced myself that I was a descendant of the Salem witches.
Oh, who didn't? Yeah. Oh,
exactly. Who wasn't?
Desperately wanted to be related to a hung witch. Desperately.
So badly. All I wanted was to know that I was related to a woman who was hanged by an asshole man for being a witch.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think that story kind of you know, like, being kind of a kid who wasn't very popular and was kind of weird. It was really fascinating, a story to me, too, that was basically about the mean girls of Salem had gotten all the cool chicks murdered by making up stories about them. So that resonated when I was like a preteen.
Yeah. Wow, you're right. I didn't ever think about that, but yeah. Because I was also a weird kid that everyone, like, not everyone, but a lot of people were like, "You're fucking weird." I'm like,
Yeah, it's fine.
I get it.
It's okay.
It's okay. We're fine now. They find their weirdos, yes. And then they thrive.
Exactly. If I ever interact with a weird kid now, I tell him, "Listen, you're going to be so much cooler than these ding-dongs in your class. They're going to be done by 25. You will just be getting started at 25. That's what I'd say to my little self, I suppose.
I love that, though. do we want to wrap this up and give us our rating out of 5? Do you want anything
else? That sounds
good. Cool. Okay, Terry, how many pour one out for Aunties out of 5 do you give Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
I feel like I have to give this 4.5. A lot of it probably is nostalgia. And, you know, there probably are things that I could nitpick. But I just rewatching this movie just brought me so much joy and also made me realize how intricate some of the themes actually were in this little movie that was made for kids. The humor still got me. Like, I remember last night just cackling over. There's a moment where one of the Thompson's friends, Gloria, comes over and she's like, Donald, that man is flying, because she sees like Rick Moranis like soaring over the yard. And there's this, it's such a silly little aside, but it just made me start giggling with joy over like this idea of just seeing poor little Rick Moranis like zooming over his yard and this woman just sort of seeing him out of the corner of her eye. And it just, yeah, this movie's great. I think it respects kids. I think that it does stuff that is both for kids and for adults, and it does so in such a fun, terrifying, and traumatic way. So I'm going to have to give this, in terms of what we're talking about, 4.5. What about you, Mary Beth?
I think I'm also going to have to go 4.5, because when we came in, I was like, this is definitely a solid 4. I love this movie, nostalgia, blah, blah, blah. But the more we talked about the themes of it, like, I didn't catch on as much to some of the stuff that we talked about in terms of like feeling small, being a latchkey kid, because I didn't have that experience as much. Like, I had a little bit of that, but I more was looking at like the divorce stuff. So just talking about this movie has made me appreciate even more like how it wanted to take a movie for kids and make it still very have serious moments and also fun and cool to look at, and like these beautiful sets. And it's just, the whole experience was amazing to go back and see, and because I hadn't watched it in a long time. And so it was just such a great experience to go back and watch it and then just talk about it with you guys in such an intelligent way. It has just made me really appreciate this movie for something more than just like a scary kids movie, but as something that was really trying to get at like a deeper theme. That, I'm sorry, the cat needing you at your neck is so fucking cute. So I'm like getting cute. Distracted in a good way. It's so fucking
She's
cute.
She's a good kitty. She's a good friend.
But yeah, I think that this movie is a lot more than I ever gave it credit for. And I think a lot of people don't give it the credit that I think it's due, especially after talking about it. So yeah, 4.5 is my rating. Katie, with the final word, how many pour one out for aunties?
Okay.
Aunties.
I'm going to do 4 out of 5, because I do feel that the original, I'd love to read the original version of the script. I bet it had even more edge than what ended up on the screen. I don't love the way the Disney almost killed a director I like, so we're docking it an aunt just for that. But however, what I really appreciate, I think you're right, Terry, this movie understands kids, and this movie like speaks to stuff that will resonate with kids, but not in an overly obvious way. Like incorporates it in a fun story, but while speaking to things that are actually going to resonate kids. And it, like I said, it understands kids, and that's really cool. Yeah, I really like that about it. And I think it is a testament to the quality of the writing. And all three of us were able to connect things that we had in our lives that made us feel like alienated. We're able to connect with the movie on all these different levels, you know, and none of that is, it's all under the surface of the movie. It's all in the writing. So,
well, thank you so much, Katie, for joining us to talk about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Where can our listeners find you, and what do you have coming up that you'd like to share?
Well, okay, I've got a big one I'd like to share. If you're in Chicago, please come out. We're doing 30 Nights of Terror at the drive-in. We've got some really exciting stuff. Okay, so there's 3 nights I want to plug in particular. 1, we're doing a J-horror night with Ringu and Dark Water, and I can't wait.
Oh my God.
I can't wait. We're doing Alien night with Fire in the Sky and the McPherson tape, which I can't
wait.
Oh, I can't wait to show Fire in the Sky at the drive-in. Speaking of traumatizing movies, so many people I've talked to say it's the scariest movie they've ever seen. Like,
we talked to Carla Rossi about Anthony Hudson about that film, and that the alien abduction has peers.
So scary. And then also, I just want to plug, if you're in Chicago and you're looking for something to do on Halloween night, we will be showing Trick or Treat, the Michael Dougherty one. So It will be highly seasonal. Yeah, I saw.
Highly seasonal.
Not a fan or anything.
So if you go on my Twitter at Rife with Katie, my pinned tweet has all the info on that. And then also you can just go to musicboxtheater.com and it's there in the top splash of the page. You can click on it and buy all the tickets there. So that would be great. And you can also find me on avclub.com. I publish stuff most days on there. So, yeah.
Cool. And then everyone will have links in the description of the podcast so you can get all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. But listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? Send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter. I am at MB McAndrews.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter at Scarred Podcast.
And please, if you can, just throw out a rating and a review and make sure you're subscribed.
Please do. Please, please. Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong.
These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th.
We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.